Welcome to East Meets West, episode 193. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And we are this week's halftime show for TWiT on the Super Bowl. We're the counter programming. We are the Puppy Bowl for TWiT. The Puppy Bowl is to Animal Planet as East Meets West is to This Week in Tech.
I wish we were that cute. I can only wish.
We'll never be as cute as puppies. And they also have kittens and
what Puppy Bowl has kittens?
Yeah, the halftime show is always kittens. And then they had a sky cam full of like gerbils or something.
It's very pet story.
Very Richard. I mean, never mind. So you've been watching the Super Bowl, Roger?
I actually watched more of the pre-show leading up to it. You know, where they're talking about all the players and all that stuff.
Interesting. Yeah.
The actual game. I like the pageantry that surrounds the Super Bowl more so than the actual game, especially if there aren't teams in there that I have any real strong connection to. I don't know what it is. It's the amount of, in some cases, the solemnness of some of the things that they do, like, you know, like getting the Super Bowl trophy is like akin to winning, like, you know, maybe it is an Olympic gold medal. It's something that is a testament to one's athletic ability and sporting nature. And I don't know. It just seems, in many ways, it reminds me of those old World War II, or not old, but when they do kind of a retrospective World War II and they talk about all the people involved and they, you know, have these giant celebrations that, or not celebrations, but kind of a look back on particular personalities, like where they came from and how that, you know, upbringing just, you know, molded who they were on the field, and how, you know, what they do on the field is a culmination of, you know, all these years of experience of sweat, tears, and I don't know. It just
sounds like you like the documentary aspect better.
Yeah, I've always actually, you know, I've never been a super big NFL fan. I mean, I like football, but I wasn't like, you know, I got to watch football every Monday night. But when the NFL films come out, when they do the kind of like, you know, the underdog team coming from like, you know, fifth or sixth way down and they slowly grind their way up, you know, and they're like they're super underdogs for the Super Bowl. And I don't know, it just gets the emotion pumping. I don't know. They're really good at it.
if a neighbor down the hallway from me, her mom lives with her. Her mom's, I'd guess, in her 60s probably. And I ran into her coming up the stairs. I'm like, oh, you're going to watch the game? She's like, I guess if it's on, I'll probably just watch the last 15 minutes, though. That's the only part that's interesting. So she's like the opposite of you. She just wants to know the results. She wants to see that concentrated drama at the end of the game.
You know, I'll watch the highlight reels and I will watch the last 10 minutes because, you know, frankly, that is the most exciting part of the Super Bowl because everything gets decided in those final minutes and every timeout, everything that draws it out feels like an intentional dramatic, you know, underscored everything. Like, what do they do? They're down by a touchdown and a field goal. How are they going to make it up in like 5 minutes? They got to pull something off amazing. And they have all these timeouts as the coach and the quarterback converse and figure out strategy. And I don't know. I'm sure they didn't plan it out that way, or maybe they did, but it really kind of lends a certain amount of a pathos.
That's not usually the way the Super Bowl is. Usually the way the Super Bowl is, it's a blowout. You already know who's going to win, like, after the first couple quarters, after the first half. It's starting to look like that in this game this year. Who knows? I mean, I don't want to make any predictions because by the time most people listen to this on the audio podcast, they'll know the end. But, you know, it's usually not much drama in the Super Bowl, unlike the championship games.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, go ahead. Oops, sorry.
I was going to say, are you a big fan of The who are playing the halftime show right now?
Mainly because one of them is named Roger.
Seriously, come now.
No, I'm a fan of
The
Who.
Are you doing that thing where you start to be too polite because we're streaming live on TWiT?
All right, so if you really want to know...
That was a ridiculously nice thing, cute thing for you to say, Roger.
All right, so the thing with me and The Who is that every teacher I've had since junior high and up has made some reference to The Who in their life. And for me, it's always a marker of someone who was raised in like the late 60s, early 70s, in that period where it was, you know, the focal point of, you know, high school, early college. And so it kind of seems old to me.
Yeah.
But I do like the fact...
Incredibly old.
Huh?
And that's what we've been getting in Super Bowl halftimes. We've been getting old, like acts from the
60s. Geriatric rock.
Paul McCartney, the Rolling Stones, even U2, which isn't quite as old. And I saw somebody on Twitter, I think it might have been O. Willis, who said, thank you, Janet Jackson, for dooming us to old people acts during the Super Bowl halftime.
Old safe acts.
Yeah, because you figure they're not going to offend people. They're probably not going to, you know, pull off their shirt and show a boob.
Although, you know what? It could happen. But, you know, really, does anyone want to see that?
Well, first of all, yeah, Pete Townsend showing a boob, that's offensive. Wait, in a whole different way than people usually think.
I always thought Pete Townsend was in jail, but I could be wrong. Remember the whole
child? No, I believe that's him, unless they have a replacement. He's out there with a bandana and a nice fedora playing guitar.
I'll say this about The Who. They do mark a lot of special occasions with Who songs, just like they do with Beatles and Rolling Stones and other.
I actually love it. Like The Who, I'm a big Who fan. There's especially the Kids Are All Right album. Big fan of that album, but and I don't.
Yeah,
mind,
but you were also like playing a radio DJ, so
yeah, exactly.
Maybe you were indoctrinated because you played the LP so many times.
But Who were the mods. They were still trying to be there were mods and there were rockers. And The Who were definitely that mod scene, you know, driving around Vespas, wearing the skinny ties. I always kind of tended towards that side of things myself. I like
trying to imagine you at a skinny
specials.
Actually, I'm trying to imagine you at a ska concert.
Why?
I don't know.
Why, Roger?
Don't be defensive.
Well, explain what you mean by that.
Trying to imagine you?
Why would you have to imagine me at a ska concert? What does that mean?
Because I don't normally associate you with ska and The Who.
And why is that?
You're pretty straight-laced and you work at a company where everyone wears like khakis. It's almost
that
like...
That is so not true. The sales department maybe has a few people who wear khakis. That is not true at all. You are totally stereotyped. You are profiling. You're racist, Roger.
I am just a companyist. That is true.
You're a 40-year-old white male.
You can actually
accuse
me of being classist because
I used to joke
with everyone who worked around Second Street. It's like you can always tell who the CNET people are because they always look like they came out of Macy's, but you know they got the business casual.
That is so not true, and you know it because you worked for GameSpot. And none of those people wore that stuff, and they all worked at CNET.
Actually, in GameStop, it's pretty much a t-shirt and jeans.
Exactly.
But that's not the rest of...
You're talking about CNET.com. You're saying everyone who works at... So Molly Wood, Brian Tong, those people wear blue shirts and khakis. Me, I wear a blue shirt and khakis.
You wear a blue shirt on occasion. I've seen it.
So do you.
Mm-hmm. But I wear jeans, no khakis.
I wear jeans. I wear cords. I don't wear khakis very often, if at all, lately.
Lately?
You're saying because I've worn khakis once in my life, I'm that kind of guy. I find that
offensive. Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying, Tom. I've pigeonholed you. It's going to take you half a decade to work yourself out of that.
I think you're over-stereotyping and have a misimpression of
a misimpression.
People. Yeah. I think you have sort of a shallow a way of dealing with people, if that's what you think.
Shallow, very, very limited understanding of the CNET hierarchy and the social.
Doesn't have anything to do with CNET particularly. I mean, maybe you have some fatuous hate of CNET that you want to characterize them that way, but you're saying that
you can't imagine me at a ska
show because you think I wear like a light blue shirt and khakis all the time. It's just not true.
But you do wear them on occasion.
I have been known to wear a pair of khakis, perhaps, but it's certainly not my dominant wardrobe. And even if it was, why couldn't I go to a ska concert?
Where do you for me, I'm just having difficulty seeing you at one. If I see you at one, then I'll have that picture in my mind.
I've been at one. I can't imagine you going to any concert.
Future show, I can pull from that memory.
You can pull from what memory?
No, see, if you actually go to, say you go to something easy, like a Social D concert. Then I can picture you at the Social D concert. And then if there's ever
a future... I've been to a Social D concert. I saw them with Sonic Youth at the Redburn Arena in Bloomington, Illinois.
Still, nothing coming up. It's all static. Maybe if I photoshopped your head on top of it.
I've got you. Actually, TechESC is pointing out that I'm being obtuse, and he's right. He's calling me. I'm not going to break the bottle over Roger's head.
How can you break? You're like, 15 miles away.
Oh, I could find a way. So everybody, you know, it's become a cliche that people watch the Super Bowl for the ads. Have you been watching the Super Bowl for the ads? I kind of think that's over. I think that ended a couple years ago where the ads are okay. There's some funny ones, but it's not like, wow, the ads are always amazing at the Super Bowl.
You know, the thing with the ads is so many sites immediately after the Super Bowl put like the best Super Bowl commercials and they put YouTube links to them. So it's like, why sit through the game when you can just wait for the site and then you can click on everything? And you'll have enough time because you can watch it that evening and you'll have enough information for the water cooler the next day at the office.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people on Twitter and in the chat room here are like, we can't see the ads because we're seeing the BBC feed of this. Or we're seeing, like Randy from The Instance was saying, I'm in Canada. I see a whole different set of ads. I see ads for Tim Hortons. I don't see those ads. But you can go and find them on YouTube. You can find them on Mahalo. CBS actually has them up already. It's CBS.
But you can't watch them if you're outside of the country, right? If it's on CBS.
If you're at CBSSports.com, probably not. I don't know if you can at YouTube. I imagine they're not blocking it.
Now, I'm curious, do like all the other broadcasts in foreign countries, do they do the equivalent? Are there, you know, similar like Super Bowl ads in Canada or the UK? I don't know, probably not so much the UK, but okay, say Canada. Does Tim Hortons do something particularly, you know, extremely funny with their donuts or donut holes? Coffee.
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Randy didn't mention that in his Twitter, whether the ads were particularly cool. He just said they were different kinds of ads. They were for Canadian companies.
Actually, Randy brings up a good point. The BBC has no ads.
Correct. So what do the BBC's doing is they whenever there's a cut to ads, they go to some people sitting in a room and they start chatting about what just happened in the game.
Wow. I'd rather watch the ads.
Actually, it's not bad. I think you can get it at Justin TV or someplace like that. That, you know, in one of those temporary rebroadcasts. Also, a bunch of people in the chat room pointing out superbowlads.fanhouse.com. And by a bunch of people, I mean TechLord32 because he's the only one who did it, but he did it twice. Superbowlads.fanhouse has all the ads. Oh, so
I wonder who the 31 other tech lords are. Perhaps it's like a parliament of tech lords.
No worries. Thanks, Tech Lord. Appreciate that link. So we got a lot of comments after the last episode. We should probably take a page through them. Eric sent in two excellent teacher names. We were talking about homeschooling and about the different teachers and the odd names our teachers had. How about this one? Fifth grade algebra for Eric. Bowl slaw linga. And
sounds like
Conrad Bebo for high school physics. Bebo spelled B-I-B-E-A-U.
Bebo, Conrad. Actually, Conrad nothing Bebo, that sounds like a name that you would come up with for a cartoon character.
Conrad Bebo. Yeah. And Eric said it sounded like a superhero's secret identity, which it's kind of both of those. It does sound like a made-up name, though.
Yeah, it does definitely feels synthetic.
Olsla Linga just sounds foreign. Like doesn't even somebody sound mistranslated
Bolsla. It sounds like someone mocking a foreign language.
Yeah, like exactly. Name, like the name is actually Boleslav Lingariso or something like that. And then the person who wrote it down is like, I don't know, Boleslav Linga, whatever. You know, that's how they used to get all those names shortened at Ellis Island back in the day.
Just cut off a couple of vowels and maybe cut it by like three syllables.
Yeah. Good teacher names. Josh Hill said, I could never get into Battlestar Galactica. It was so boring. And despite what everyone was saying, I could never understand what was the catch. So I heard that the producer, Michael Moore, said that they were looking into giving something to a non-BSG fan that they would like Caprica, that they were doing something different. I feel as if I'm missing out on something big with this, same as Lost. Maybe if they put it out in book form, I'd deal better.
I don't know. BSG was something that you had to grow into. I'll admit, like, the first few episodes really weren't all that compelling for me personally.
But I actually didn't get into Battlestar Galactica until season 2 because I watched the miniseries and like you, I watched the first couple episodes and I just kind of fell off. But then when I watched them all in a row, I got sucked in. And I think that happens. I've mentioned that before. When you watch a bunch of episodes in a row from a show, you don't tend to expect every episode to carry as much weight as you do when you watch it from week to week. You want every episode to be amazing. It's a little more forgiving when you watch them in sequence.
Once you see discover what the story arc is between the episodes, I think you feel a little more compelled because you now understand what the motivation, the kind of reasoning, you know, for everyone's actions. And then, you know, when you have an episode that might not dwell too heavily on it, you still have an understanding of it and you can kind of get an understanding of why people are, or at least characters, are behaving the way they are.
And some people just don't like shows. I mean, Rombo55 says he usually agrees with me. He even has a dog named Django. But regarding the show Lost, he started watching Lost from DVD, got as far as 6 episodes, and just couldn't take it anymore. And he's watching it the way I think it's best, like one after the other. He says, I believe the survivors of a plane crash on a deserted island would be doing everything possible to help each other survive. It is human nature to work together after a tragedy to ensure the survival of the group. They would not be backstabbing and working against each other, at least not from the start. If they had left out the soap opera, I would probably still be watching. The sci-fi elements are all fine and good with me, but I guess portraying realistic human interaction is either considered too hard or too boring.
Well, someone brought that up, like, when BSG first came out. It was like, why does everyone have some sort of, you know, obvious, you know, human character flaw? Like, it's, you know, everyone has an issue that constantly weighs in on their relationships with everyone else. It's not like, you know, I mean, humans are flawed and they all have, you know, particular hang-ups and stuff that each and every one of us has, but... You know, it's not like when I go to work, I wear it on my sleeve and say, Tom, I don't like coffee. Everyone's drinking coffee. And someone said it just felt like it was forced in order to generate conflict. It didn't feel realistic. It didn't feel natural, I guess, would be the best term for it. And I think Ronbo's making the same point, which is true. I mean, you know, initially after a plane crash, yeah, you can see people kind of single-mindedly working for survival. But once you get over that phase and you have your immediate needs taken care of, then, you know, I guess it could break out into the Lord of the Flies Lost.
But the thing is, if the show started out the first season, everybody got along, everyone was pulling together and just trying to, like, you know, discover more papayas and how to hunt boar, it would have been freaking boring. I mean, that's the problem with
telling a story. But isn't that what Gilligan's Island is about?
Your story has to have conflict. Gilligan's Island had conflict, right? There was conflict between the Howls and everybody else because they were rich and they wanted everything to be easy and they wanted other people to serve them. I mean, you can overinterpret it, obviously, but you have to have some conflict for there to be humor in a comedy show or there to be any kind of interesting story. So, I think Rombo's got a point, right? Which is like maybe it was overdone. I don't think it was, but I think it's, you know, it's a valid concern, but you have to have that conflict. You can't have everybody get along. And I think the stress of a plane crash and then a weird monster that you can't see and then these strange, you know, numbers being broadcast over a frequency and they don't know what's going on, that all points to, you know, some stressors that probably would make people a little more on edge than they would be otherwise. So I kind of bought it, but maybe I'm just being forgiving because I know it's
a story.
You enjoy
the series.
Well, this is before I enjoyed it though. Yeah. I mean, I was forgiving in the early days because I'm like, hey, this is, you got to be able to tell a story. So I'm going to say, okay, there's going to be some conflicts. Are these conflicts believable? And I did feel that all the conflicts were believable. They weren't just backstabbing for no reason. There was always some real motivation behind it.
Kind of like on Survivor.
I bought, Rombo didn't. So there you go. Will actually had a different objection to watching it all in a chunk on DVD. He said, I preferred watching it on television because when I saw it all in a chunk on DV, I kept hearing the same music cues over and over again. Michael Giacchino creates some beautiful music for the show, but it's just way too repetitive when you watch it, or when he's saying when you watch it one episode after another.
See, I'm wondering, well, is that music played throughout the show, or is it really prominent in the open and the end of the show, or the close?
Well, yeah,
of the
episode? Obviously there's the open and the end of the show, and there's themes, right? There's like every series has. There's a love theme, and Doctor Who has the Doctor's theme, and a Rose Tyler theme, and a time travel theme, and they have these themes, and some of them change from episode to episode, but some of them repeat, right? There's a Kate theme from Lost. So I guess he's just extra sensitive to hearing those themes.
Yeah, I mean, BSG had that issue too. I mean, after a while, you kind of got annoyed with some of the music because it was there to denote certain plot points, you know, especially if it related to, you know, some sort of metaphysical, you know, a direction to for the fleet to go in. And they would play it over. And yeah, it was part of the hint, but it kind of grated on me. You know, if I were to have watched back-to-back episodes of Battlestar.
Maybe I'm just not paying enough attention, but it never really bothered me to hear those themes. And I also think that the music in Lost is incredibly good. It's very moving. It's very well done. I was thinking about this today, actually, because I watched on the DVD of the special Doctor Who episodes that just came out, they've got a special feature of something called the BBC Proms. BBC Proms is a series of concerts, usually of classical music, that is shown. And you can get in with really cheap tickets, but you have to stand. Mm-hmm. Most of them happen in the Royal Albert Hall. And that's where the promenade refers to, because originally in 1895 or whenever, the idea was that people could just walk around while the music was playing. And so it would be appealing to more of an audience who didn't want to come hear classical music and just sit around. So they did one of these BBC Proms around the music of Doctor Who, and they had Freema Agyeman hosting, who's my favorite of the companions. She played Martha Jones, and it was really interesting to relive that music, some of which is just amazing. And I started to think about the fact that our classical music these days, not entirely, obviously, but the popular classical music is soundtrack. It's from movies in most cases, mm-hmm. but it more and more is coming from TV shows that really pay attention and pour some money into getting composers to make really good music.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, most of the things like both Beethoven's Fifth, people remember them not so much because they heard it on the radio, because it's more because they heard it on a TV show or they heard it on in the soundtrack to a movie. You know, Chariots of Fire. I mean, that whole theme by Vangelis, I mean, that's iconic for the movie, and you can't really separate the two. Granted, it was actually written for the movie, but, you know, oftentimes there are certain 80s songs that I hear, either from Chicago or you know, some other band, and every time I hear it, I just think of the movie. I think of Karate Kid. I think of, yeah. of a John Hughes movie, and you can't separate those two anymore because now you associate them. It's kind of annoying because when it happens to a commercial, like when Toyota did yeah. that one ad, what was it called? It was like an old 50s song. And every time I heard it on the radio, because it used to be played a lot on the oldie station, I would just think of the Toyota commercial, and it just spoiled it for me, and I couldn't listen to it anymore. It's like the car song, what's the one that Best Buy uses? Oh, crap. I wonder if anyone knows.
Cars, the band The Cars, Best Buy uses one of their songs. And
I hear that song, I think of Best Buy, and it irritates the hell out of me. It's like, gosh, dang it.
Just what I needed.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah.
Can't stand it.
Took a second for me to remember it. Okay, well, I guess there's not much controversy there. I mean, the soundtrack is the most popular classical music of our day, and the composers for TV shows and film soundtracks, the John Williamses is it going too far to say they're the Beethovens and Mozarts of the modern era?
They're not as technically complex as I would say the old, like a Beethoven or Mozart or even an Aaron Copland. But they do underscore a certain emotional and psychological state for a lot of people when they hear, for example, the soundtrack to Gladiator. There are moments in it where, you know, when you hear the Hans Zimmer piece, you think and you imagine certain things, and that's what music is supposed to do. It's supposed to evoke emotion. It's not supposed to be something that you play in the elevator just to pass the time as you move between the second and the eighth floor.
And when you tie it in with pictures, when you tie it in with movies and television shows, it deepens that emotional connection because you associate it with whatever was going on the screen at that time, which presumably you're somewhat invested in. So it gives it meaning that classical music doesn't really have until it's used in one of those situations like Flight of the Bumblebees in Apocalypse Now, right? I mean, that was an incredible piece of music before Apocalypse Now ever came out, but now it is indubitably associated with that scene of the helicopters taking off. Because everyone who sees it, it just gets kind of bound in your memory. It's flame
kind of burned in there. Well, you know, there's a school of argument that says it's a bad thing because, you know, the point of the music was for a person to kind of imagine and develop their own emotional reaction to it without having, you know, it literally spelled out for you in front of you and on a giant screen. You can take a pro or con view of that, but you know, there are certain cases, like I've mentioned, you know, just a minute ago, like certain songs that you can no longer separate from that imagery, and that's not always a good thing. You know,
Eric saying it was Flight of the Valkyrie, not Bumblebee. My mistake.
Oh, the Bumblebee is the Green Hornet. Yeah. Every time you hear that, I think of the Green Hornet.
A little slip of the tongue there. Thanks for catching that, Eric. All right, let's finish off with Cool B. We talked a lot about homeschooling last week, and Cool B has been listening to the show and commenting at subbrilliant.com/EMW for quite a long time. And he wrote, as someone who was homeschooled from the fifth grade on, I'd like to add in my thoughts. My last public school teacher was actually the one who recommended to my parents that they either enroll me in a private school or homeschool me, since they didn't feel the public school system would be able to challenge me enough mentally. Since homeschooling was something my parents had been thinking about for a while anyway, and private schools aren't cheap, that was that. As for the social aspect mentioned, I wasn't very social to begin with, but I think I was probably more social after becoming homeschooled. I had joined Scouts while in public school and did continue to do that, but there was also a homeschool support group co-op we joined. Plus, my best friend's family decided to start homeschooling him and his older sister about the same time, so while they didn't join the support group, we'd often do field trip type stuff together.
That's actually really cool. I know anecdotally a few people whose grandparents actually homeschooled them because the parents were busy working, but you know, their parents' parents, their grandparents, had more than enough time on their hand in order to help educate the grandkids. And as soon as they hit high school, they went to a public high school.
Kind of reminds me of the old one-room schoolhouse days.
Little House on the Prairie?
Well, not just Little House on the Prairie. My dad was in a one-room schoolhouse in his younger days, in his early elementary years. And that was in the late 30s, early 40s back in southern Illinois. So it wasn't even that far back. But you got really intense education and you were with people whose families all knew each other just because that was the situation. The only difference being you had a school teacher who was, you know, part of the community. One of the families probably had kids of her own. And you know, other than that, and go into a one-room school, very similar to homeschooling. Homeschooling is sort of the privatized, more free, open way of doing the one-room schoolhouse method, I guess. Plus, you don't use slates.
You know, and I know a lot of people talk about it, especially when they think about sending their kids to school and they're kind of looking at their options. It's one that, you know, they'll have on the back burner. Something that maybe they might not discuss too seriously at first, but you know, over time, you start thinking, oh, maybe we could do this or we could do that. Or we could get a bunch of people together and then we could just rotate, you know, teachers for different subjects.
All right. The Super Bowl has resumed while we were talking, so we're no longer the halftime show. We'll probably wrap up here in a couple minutes. But Matt 97 started off a little conversation. He posted on subbrilliant.com/EMW that he has enjoyed the mix of serious and lighthearted items on the podcast, but currently it seems that the lighthearted items have taken over, in his opinion. He wanted to know, is this a new direction for the podcast?
Well, I can honestly say that we started out as kind of a hodgepodge potpourri podcast to begin with. We used to talk about how people pronounce soda and pop in different parts of the country. And I call it.
Yes. You know, it's always been a random topic. So the topics will stray from time to time, depending on what we've been reading, what we've been interested in. That's sort of the idea of East meets West. And I know that's not everybody's cup of tea, and that's cool. And I also know what Matt's saying. We went on a kind of a run there of talking a lot about politics, a lot about healthcare, a lot about climate change, a lot of serious topics. And then probably in the past month or so, we've kind of taken a break from that, maybe to clear our heads a little bit. I don't know. You'd have to psychoanalyze us to figure it out. But, you know, what, the TV season came back and we've been talking about TV. And
I mean, these are the things that are currently on our mind, or what we feel really interested in at the time.
Yeah.
That's not to say that we were blowing off those subject matters or those topics. But, you know, after a while, you can only talk so much about healthcare and the, you know, political system after, what was it, 2 months? We were going through it, and it's like, you kind of burnt out on it.
Seemed like a year, but that doesn't mean we'll never not, you know, that we'll never talk about something serious again. And homeschooling was serious last week. I mean, that was a serious sort of situation. So yeah, we'll take it back and forth. It'll come and go in waves, but it's always good to hear. You know, if people are like, hey, you know what, I like a little more serious stuff in the mix. So. The honest truth is, and Roger can attest to this, we never know what we're going to talk about until we start the show. Even when we've planned, like, let's talk about this, this, and this, we start the show, we may just start talking about something totally different, and it just carries us off.
Which is the, kind of the point.
Yeah, I mean, East meets West refers to the fact that Roger and I, since we first started working together in 1999, have had these little arguments where he's like, your Western perspective is, you know, not understanding me because I'm from the Eastern heritage. And then there's also the vice versa, where I'm from the East part of the United States, Roger's from the West. But honestly, the show is just sort of random.
Yes.
How did Veronica put it? I put it on our website's about page.
Always hilarious,
sometimes random, and definitely bizarre. So that's.
But we haven't gotten to fetishes yet, so it can't be too bizarre.
Yeah, boy, there's not a day goes by that you don't bring up fetishes.
That was last night,
and the night before that, and the day before that. All right, thanks everybody for watching or listening, however you consumed it. Don't forget, we stream live on the Twit Network every Sunday at 5 p.m. Pacific. That's 8 p.m. Eastern Time at live.twit.tv. Thanks to Leo Laporte for letting us do that. And thanks to Jammerbee for producing it and getting us the audio file so we could post it up. If you'd like to make a comment, do so. Subbrilliant.com/EMW is the website. And we will talk to you next week.
All right, thanks for watching or listening. Bye.